I think we're on April the 6th, 1922. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So the introduction says the effects of the acts done in the divine will. In the divine will, the soul places herself at the level of the creator. That's the bit you underline. Okay. As I was in my usual state, my sweet Jesus carried me outside of myself and showed me masses of people crying, homeless, prey to the greatest desolation, towns collapsed, streets deserted and uninhabitable. That makes me ask the question, is she looking at Hiroshima or Nagasaki? Okay, because the Lord always shows the prophets something ahead of time so that they, the intercession and the reparation is done for the people who had no time, because those people died in seconds. You know, they had absolutely no time. And the way the Lord works out is that they have all been prayed for and reparation has all been done for them, which shows you the extraordinary mercy of God. You know, while an unbeliever looking at it thinks, you know, this is a hopeless situation, in fact, it's all prepared for. One could see nothing but heaps of stones and rubble. Only one point remained untouched by the scourge. That's what makes me say Nagasaki or Hiroshima, because of the, you remember the Jesuit community?
Yes.
And the community of Maximilian Kolbe. They were both of them separately in different places were the only thing left standing. That's why it makes me decide on that. Otherwise, you could say, well, maybe she's seeing Dresden in China, in Germany at the Second World War, but it doesn't seem to me to be that. My God, what pain to see these things and live. I looked at my sweet Jesus and he didn't deign to look at me. Rather, he cried bitterly and with a voice broken by crying, he said, my daughter, man has forgotten heaven for the earth. Isn't that interesting? We're back at that point again, aren't we? It is justice that what is earth be taken away from him and that he go wandering, unable to find shelter, so that he remain that heaven exists. Now, there's another purpose for chastisement, which is quite clear, to try and make them understand that heaven exists and heaven is the most important address that you should have. Man has forgotten the soul for the body. Now, it's the second thing again. So the body has to suffer. It's a wonderful explanation of chastisement, this. So everything is for the body, pleasures, comfort, sumptuousness, luxury and the like. The soul is starving, deprived of everything, and in many it is dead, as if they didn't have it. Now, it is justice that their bodies be deprived so that they may remember that they have a soul. See, the logic is very interesting there. Oh, how hard man is. His hardness forces me to strike him more. Who knows whether he might soften under the blows, okay? So for hardness of heart, look up Revelation 16, 9. Revelation 16, 9, 11 and 21. Now, in Revelation 16, 9, 11 and 21, you're told that at the great chastisement that the people cursed God. And you're told three times, that's the 9, 11 and 21, that instead of softening, they actually cursed God for the chastisement. So Louisa said, I felt my heart being tortured. And he said, you suffer very much in seeing the world as if it wanted to roll, and water and fire spilling out of their boundaries. As if the earth wanted to roll. You mean spin? She wouldn't have used the term spin. And water and fire spilling out of their boundaries. We're living at the stage where water and fire spill out of their boundaries. Okay. Hurling themselves at man. So there's the nature rebelling against man. Therefore, let us withdraw together into your bed and let us pray together for the destiny of man. In my will, I will feel your heart beating over the entire face of the earth, giving me a heartbeat for all, a word that says love. And as I strike the creatures, your heartbeat will place itself in the way so that the blows will be less hard. And upon touching them, may bring the balm of my love and of yours. Is that amazing statement? Okay. So even in the chastisement itself, Louisa is asked to participate so that people even experiencing the chastisement will somehow know, maybe in the depths of their being, that the God of love is actually touching them to try and bring some kind of spiritual healing. Louisa remained all afflicted, and she said, "More so since, as we withdrew, my sweet Jesus hid in my interior, but so deep that he almost would not let himself be felt any more. What pain, what torment, the thought of the scourges terrorized me, and his privations gave me mortal pains." Now, in this state, this is very important, she has described total agony here. "In this state, I tried to fuse myself in the holy will of God." Now, to me, that's great consolation, because it's saying that there are times when it's going to be difficult for you to do it. "And I said, my love, in your will, what is yours is mine." You see, there's that wonderful statement, okay? "All created things are mine, the sun is mine, and I give it to you in return. So that all the light and the heat of the sun, each drop of its light and heat, may tell you that I love you, I adore you, I bless you, I praise you for all." That lovely little round. "The stars are mine, and in every flickering of the stars, I seal my I love you, infinite and immense for all. The plants and the flowers and the water, the fire and the air are mine, and I give them to you in return, that all of them may say to you, in the name of all, I love you with that same eternal love with which you created us." So there's a very nice little round there, if you're ever in a hurry, because it says it all in a few sentences. But if I wanted to say everything, it would be too long. She's got to stop saying that particular sentence. "Then Jesus, moving in my interior, told me, my daughter, how beautiful are the prayers and the acts done in my will. How the creature is transformed in God, the Creator himself, and gives him in return for what he has given to her. I created everything for man, and I gave everything to him as gift." That's Colossians 1, 15 to 17. Colossians 1, 15 to 17. "In my will, the creature rises up to her God and Creator and finds him in the act in which he created all things to give them to her as gift. And trembling before the multiplicity of so many gifts, not having within herself the creative power to create as many things for as many as she has received, she offers him his own things to requite him in love." I love that expression, offering him his own things. That's like the child coming in from the garden and they've taken your favourite rose and they haven't even plucked it properly and they hand it to you with love. And it's very important to only look at the love, isn't it? Yeah. If you look at anything else, you might have a problem, at least if you're me. "I gave you the sun, I gave you stars, flowers, water, fire, air, to give you love." Everything is to give you love. "And you are grateful, you accepted them, and putting my love in circulation, you gave me love in return for them." That's a wonderful explanation of what rounds are. Okay, so if you ever just want to do a short little summary on rounds, there you have it. And there aren't 11 steps to it. "The notes of my love resounded again over all created things, and with one voice you gave me the love which I made flow over the whole of creation. Now, in my will, the soul places herself at the level of her creator, and in his own will she receives and she gives." So there you are on a divine level. It's easy to read, but to try and take it in is another matter. Okay. "Oh, what a contest between the creature and the creator happens. If all could see it, they would remain stupefied at seeing that in my will, the soul becomes a little god, small g." Now, if you read the book I gave you or got you to read last year or the year before, you become a little Elohim, because that's the Hebrew word. Okay. But everything by virtue of the power of my will. So I want to give you Psalm 8. Lord, what is man that you would even consider him? And yet you made him little less than a god, crowning him with glory and honour. So that's what you're being told here. Also, Psalm 82, verse 6. I said you are gods, all of you sons of the Most High. Now, gods in the plural is Elohim with the small e, and sons of the Most High are the same thing. Okay, but sons of the Most High also represent the angels. Okay, so you have an expression there with actual multiple meaning in its original. So I think that's a wonderful, gentle way to be able to introduce rounds to people. So April the 8th, 1922, the Most Holy Trinity concurring in the creation of man, the sorrow of Jesus in seeing the will, the intelligence and the memory of man deformed. So there's the three great powers of the soul for which he took the three crownings, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So Louisa said, finding myself in my usual state, I was thinking about the sorrow that my sweet Jesus suffered in the Garden of Gethsemane when all of our sins presented themselves before his sanctity. And Jesus, all afflicted, told me in my interior. So told me in my interior is an interior locution. Okay. My daughter, my sorrow was great and incomprehensible to the created mind, because he's told us that his sorrow is at a level that we don't understand, especially when I saw the human intelligence deformed. Look at this, the beautiful image of myself, which I reproduced in it, was no longer beautiful, but it was horrid and ugly. So if people ask you, where is the image of God in us? Jesus says it's in your intelligence. Isn't that something? Let's look at it again. Especially when I saw the human intelligence deformed, that beautiful image of myself, which I reproduced, and it was no longer beautiful, ugly, but it was ugly and it was horrid. Okay. So now he's going to take that separately and talk about it. So in the next paragraph, we're going to have the will, and the following one, the intellect, and then the following, the memory. So he's going to take them one after the other. So with regard to the will, everything's in the will. I endowed man with will, intellect and memory, the three great powers. In the first shone my celestial father. So I have father in the margin for myself. In the first John, my celestial father, who as primary act communicated his power, his sanctity and his height through which he elevated the human will. So you can see why the whole of the Old Testament is between God the Father and his people, trying to get his people to agree intellectually to doing his will. I just want to give it to you from this angle. You know, because you know that the battle was between the human will and the divine will anyway. But it's God the Father, the human will. So he elevated the human will, investing it with his own sanctity, power and nobility, leaving all currents between himself and the human will open so that it might be enriched more and more with the treasures of my divinity. So that was actually the reality in innocent Adam before the fall. Between the human will and the divine, there was neither yours nor mine. You've just heard Louisa saying everything that's yours is mine. But everything was in common with mutual accord. And you're going to hear all of this with regard to Adam when he speaks about Adam. Man was our image, our own thing. So, look at this. He veiled us. He veiled us. The image of God was in the heart of man. Okay, so if you see man, male or female, living at the level that they should be living at, you should be able to see God in that person. But we do see them, don't we? Because we often say such and such a person is very Christ-like. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're actually saying that you recognize a presence. Even if people are very far from the reality that we're talking about, they can somehow pick it up quicker than someone who is closer to you in trying to live it. I remember being quite shocked at one stage many years ago. A principal of a school, not in this country, said to me, "I need you to speak to these children." And I said, "Why?" He said, "They need to feel the impact of your presence." I said, "What are you talking about? I don't know what he was talking about. Do you know what I mean?" But then I discovered he had been a Catholic. He was no longer a Catholic. And all of a sudden, from the distance that he was at, he could see something that you and I couldn't see. Does that make sense? People in the New Age can perceive what they call an aura. And that they don't recognise that they're looking at the presence of God in you. And they're calling it by a wrong name. Do you know what I mean? But they do actually perceive it. Okay. But if we're talking to each other, we don't see it because we're all too close to each other. So man veiled the Blessed Trinity. I think that's fantastic. Just as the host veils the divine presence. Okay, so you can see a hint about consecrated hosts here, can't you? Our life was to be his, and therefore as primary act, he constituted his will free and independent. Because if we were to be truly like God, we had to be free and independent, just as the will of my celestial Father was as primary act. But how much has this will disfigured itself? Free as it was, it rendered itself the slave of the most vile passions. Ah, it is the will that is the beginning of all the evils of man. So you will realize why I pointed out all the time, from the very beginning, that Jesus would say, don't put your will into it. Don't put your will into it. It's the will is the origin of everything. And so it can no longer be recognized. How it decayed from its nobility, it is disgusting to look at. Okay, now we can't see this at all from where we're at. So the next paragraph then is the intellect and the Son, the will, the Father, the intellect, the Son, and the memory, the Holy Spirit. So this is where we're going with this. So in the second act, I, the Son of God, concurred with the endowing man with intellect, communicating to him my wisdom and knowledge of all things. Now, Genesis chapter 2 tells us in the most childlike language that Adam had knowledge of all things. Okay. So notice that if we are recovered or recovering in our relationship with God, wisdom and knowledge have got to turn up. And wisdom is the first one. Is that okay? Wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude, knowledge, piety, and the fear of the Lord. But the Lord, in these writings, always puts wisdom and knowledge together. So that by knowing them, he might enjoy them and delight in what is good. 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Delighting in what is good. But alas, what a bilge of vices is the intellect, the intelligence of the creature. He has used his knowledge to deny his creator. And unfortunately, that particular problem can manifest itself in religious people quicker than anybody else. And yeah, it's very well illustrated in the scribes and Pharisees in the gospel. They were the very ones who were completely against the truth and the grace that was being offered to them. So in the next paragraph then, it's memory and it's the Holy Spirit. Then as third act, the Holy Spirit concurred by endowing him with memory, so that in remembering so many benefits, he might be in continuous currents of love, in continuous relations. Love was to crown him, embrace him, and permeate all his life. That's Ephesians 3:16-21. Founded in love, built on love, grow in love, reach the fullness of love. But how saddened the eternal love remains. So actually, just looking at that and standing back from it, just very slightly, you'll see that the Blessed Trinity, each of the persons of the Blessed Trinity, is extremely sad by the condition of man and how they all had to concur in letting Jesus suffer interiorly to try and open all of these channels up again. This memory remembers pleasures, riches, and remembers even to sin, while the sacrosanct Trinity is cast out of the gifts which it gave to its creatures. Okay. My sorrow was indescribable at seeing the deformity of the three powers of man. We had formed our royal palace in him. So now you know where the royal palace is, in the intellect, memory, and will. This is what's lovely about this. I look at these writings as a huge big jigsaw puzzle, and there's another little piece, and there's another little piece. And I feel the same in finding the pieces here as I do with the jigsaw puzzle. I say, oh, there's the piece I've been looking at for ages. I've been looking for it. Okay. So we had formed our royal palace in him, and he had cast us out. Now, there's a terrible statement in Matthew 7:23, away from me, you evil men. But what's happening and has happened in the world that we're living in is that God has been cast out. He's been cast out of the church in many instances. He has been cast out of society. So not only has he not got his palace to live in each individual, but he's been cast out even of society itself. Well, chastisement has to follow that. Absolutely has to. Sheer logic would tell you that. So, April the 12th, 1922. Sin breaks the current of love. That's a bit like saying that the connection that I need to get my phone or my whatever it is working has been broken. It's been snapped. And it opens a current of justice. And it's up to ourselves which one we're going to be in. Now, before we even read it, I just want to remind you of something I would have said to you many times, and that is, if you look at my two hands as the two extremes of relationship that a child has with its parents, one is justice for doing things wrong, and the other is all affirmation and love for doing things right. So if the child is open to learn and love, it's only on the mercy love side. But if the child is completely rebellious, it's totally on the justice side. And in a large family, reflecting back on childhood, you know, sometimes you wonder if you had the same parents because the children veered from one side to the other. It's exactly the same in society. Some people live the whole of their lives without ever having seen the inside of a courtroom or a jail. They just know they're there. And there are other people who spend most of their lives there. They've lived their lives at the justice end of society, and they've not lived their lives at the love end. Well, it's exactly the same with us spiritually as well, that we can decide which end of the spectrum we want, we being the human race. And when the human race throws God out and goes into sin and everything, we've all veered towards justice. When we repent and we choose to live God's way and choose his wisdom, and everything, we've turned towards mercy. I'm giving you that example so you can explain to people it's our decision as to whether we get chastisement or not. It's totally our decision. Because God responds to what we're actually doing because we're free. Okay? We're going to be reading here that sin draws justice. But if you just look at the little way that I've reflected on it, you'll see how logical it is, okay? As I was in my usual state, my sweet Jesus made himself seen, all afflicted, almost in the act of meting out justice, we would say. My book says giving course to justice, which is not English. Meting out justice, we would say. But as though forced by creatures themselves. Now you know what I mean by forced. I prayed him to withhold the scourges, and he told me, my daughter, between the creator and the creature, there is nothing but currents of love. Why is that? Because God is love. 1 John 4:7. Okay. And also Psalm 145:17. God only ever acts out of love. Psalm 145:17. God only ever acts out of love. So the currents are currents of love. Sin breaks these currents and opens a current of justice. That's like saying if a person commits a crime, then they then open an account with the police and with the Justice Department. Okay? My justice defends the rights of my offended love. and my love broken between the creator and the creature. And making its way into their midst, it would want to reunite this broken love. But if man did not sin, my justice would have nothing to do with the creature. But as guilt begins, which of course starts in Genesis 3, with the fall of man, my justice places itself on the way. Do you think that I wanted to strike man? No, no. On the contrary, it grieves me. It is hard for me to touch him. Why? Because he created us in infinite love. But he himself forces me to do it and induces me to strike him. Well, I'm sure you would have witnessed that a child can actually do that to a parent, literally provoke you to do it, to see how far you would go as well. He said to Louisa, pray that man may mend his ways, so just as quickly reuniting the current of love will be able to withdraw. Now, as soon as we bring up the subject of justice, people think, oh, here we are, God of Sinai, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And I don't know what volume it's in, but I've actually drawn a picture of all the attributes of God inside. I can't draw for nuts, but I can read it. And one of the things that comes out of the picture is that justice is loving and love is just. Justice is wise and wisdom is just. All the attributes actually dovetail and concur with each other. Because we're inclined to think that mercy sort of lets you away with murder and justice is just God letting his anger out. Now, that's human stuff. You see, it's not to do with the divine. And so he explains it somewhere. I don't know what volume it's in. But that all the attributes, like his love is wise. It's not silly, stupid love. His love is wise and his love is just as well. And we're not inclined to put the attributes of God together like that. And I just want to say it so that that particular piece, which is only speaking starkly about love and justice as opposites, that you wouldn't think that they're actually combined. Is that okay? So April the 13th, 1922, the triple affirmation of wanting to live in the divine will. The soul who lives in the divine lives in the womb of the most blessed Trinity. Therefore, you're already living heaven on earth. Louisa said, I was continuing my usual prayers and my beloved Jesus, surprising me from behind my shoulders, called me by my name and said to me, you wouldn't say telling me, you'd have to say said. Okay, said to me is English. Louisa, daughter of my will, do you want to live always in my will? She said, yes, Jesus. And he said, but is it really true that you want to live in my will? And Louisa said, it is really true, my love, nor would I adapt myself to live of any other will. And Jesus said, but do you say that firmly? Oh, it's the triple affirmation. Remember, Peter? Yeah. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And it's because of that that the church asks a priest or a nun, if they're taking vows, do you really want to do this? And you're asked three times. You have to affirm it three times, you know. If you only affirm it once, they won't go ahead with the ceremony. It's actually very interesting. So what the Lord is looking for here is, and he's saying to us, that at some stage he will want an affirmation from you that you really, really, really want to go ahead. Because it's fine to be enthusiastic in the beginning and to be very interested and learn a lot and all the rest of it. It's quite another matter to give the will 100%. Okay. So I want to give you two things here from the scriptures. One is the triple yes at Sinai in Exodus 19. The triple yes. And it's also, I don't really want to put the word in here, but I just want to hint it to you, the triple fiat. Okay. God has a triple fiat and he asks a triple fiat from us as well. So the triple yes of Sinai is in Exodus 19. Do you really want to make this covenant with God? And they had to affirm it three times. And then there's the triple yes of Peter in John 21. At Sinai, it was for all the people of the Old Testament. That's Exodus 19, And for Peter, it was for all the people of the church. It wasn't just for them sort of as individuals. And so what the Lord is looking for is full knowledge and full consent. You've heard that expression before, haven't you? So, you know, we're doing our acts, we're doing our rounds, we're making our efforts and everything. But a point will come when the Lord will say, OK, are you coming into this 100%? You know, and to me, that's a red letter day in your life when that happens. And it'll happen very privately between yourself and him. And there'll be no lights flashing on the outside or bells ringing, or there'll be no announcement on the telly that something big's going to happen today and something major will happen on the earth when one person gives the complete thing. And the Lord will say in the higher volumes that if one person gives the complete gift, the 100%, he asks nothing else of that person. Nothing else. You've given everything. Isn't that incredible? And therefore, you've given God maximum glory that a creature can actually give. So here's Louise, and she's fairly well on the journey before this, isn't she? And she's already had 3 marriages with God, and here we are in volume 14. We're now in volume 3. So notice he doesn't do it immediately. He gives you time. He knows that we need time to taste it and to experience it and all the rest of it. And the church has picked that up from Peter's triple affirmation, that if someone is to become a priest, they've got to wait about 6 or 7 years to give that final yes. And if you join a community, you have to wait 4 or 5 years as well before you would give the final thing to make absolutely certain that you knew what you were doing. And the very waiting for that is underlining the seriousness of the commitment. Okay. So Louisa said, seeing myself confused, almost fearing, because she's giving a similar reaction to Peter. Why would you ask me 3 times? Didn't I tell you the first time? My life, Jesus, you make me fear with these questions. Explain yourself better. I say it firmly, but always helped by you and in the strength of your will, which involves me completely in such a way that I could not do without living in your volition. And he, heaving a sigh of relief, repeated, how happy I am to hear your triple affirmation. And he heaved a sigh of relief for Peter as well. And Moses refused point blank to go ahead with the sacrifice that ratified the covenant until the people 3 times publicly in the presence of God ratified it. So this is big stuff. This is not small. So do not fear. These are nothing but the reassurances, the reaffirmations and the confirmations so as to impress on you the triple seal of the will of the 3 divine persons. Intellect, memory, will. The seals go in there. That's why you were prepared with that message, okay? You must know that one who lives in my will must rise high. Now, high means this is the highest sanctity known to man. It's not even known except to a few people. It is so high as to live in the womb of the sacrosanct Trinity. Therefore, Saint Elizabeth of the Trinity said that means living heaven on earth. Your life and ours must be one. That means heaven, because that's what heaven is. Therefore, it is necessary. It is decorous, my book says. Did yours say that as well? Yeah. It is right. You know where you are, with whom you are, and you conform to whatever we do. And that not by force, but willingly, with love and with full knowledge and the full consent, okay, that you live there. If I can give you that in a different image, that is that, and this has happened all over Europe, that an ordinary person actually marries into a royal family. So if an ordinary person marries into a royal family, they have to conform to the royal family. They've got to conform to their way of living. And they're not free to be that, what do you call a person that's not royal? Commoner. They're not free to be a commoner anymore with all the freedom that goes with it. Actually, there's quite a lot of restrictions going with being a person in the royal family. And I think that's the only image I can think of, that we are marrying into the Most Blessed Trinity. Therefore, there's only one will. There's only one opinion. There's only one way. Could you imagine a midget telling God how to do things? And yeah, we do. We're even smaller than a midget. He told Louisa she was an atom. Okay. So now he's going to talk about us as images, okay? Icons, image. Now, do you know what our divine life is? We enjoy ourselves, not amuse. We enjoy ourselves very much in issuing from us new images of ourselves. So if you want to know what God is like, the glory of God is man fully alive. Okay. God gave us an image of himself on the earth. And it's very interesting that in the commandments, he forbade us to make an image of him. Why? Because he's made an image of him in us, but not us in a depraved state. We are in continuous act of forming our images. Of course, that's Genesis 1:27, isn't it? We are in the continuous act of forming our images, so much so that heaven and earth are filled with our images. Their shadows flow everywhere. The sun is our image, and the light is merely a shadow of ours, okay, which covers the earth. The heavens are our image, which extend everywhere and carry the shadow of our own immensity. Man is our image, who carries our power, wisdom, and love. Look at that. Power is the Father, wisdom the Son, and love the Holy Spirit. Okay. I want to give you a few scriptures for those images. Romans 8:29. We're all to become images of the Son. 1 Corinthians 15:49. And I gave you Genesis 1:27. Okay. So man is our image. So if we don't show the wisdom, the power, wisdom and love, we're not actually manifesting who it is who's dwelling within us. So we do nothing other than continuously produce our images which resemble us. Now, one must live in our will, living in our womb. One who must live in our will, living in our womb, must form many other copies of ourselves together with us. You're not allowed to do it on your own. You've got to reproduce the image. Look at that. Isn't it very important? He's telling us we have to bring other people in. She must be with us in our work. She must let copies and shadows of us come out of herself, filling the whole earth and heaven. That's why it's so important for us to form the classes and teach other people and let the thing spread and spread and spread. Okay. So now, in creating the first man, we formed him with our hands and breathing over him. That's Genesis 2:7. We gave him life. Once we made the first, all the others take origin from the first. Now, that's, he keeps on saying in these writings, we do everything with one person and all the others come out of that. So Adam was the one that starts the whole of the human race. Blessed Mother was the one that brought the whole of redemption, and Louisa, the one who brought all the divine will people. Okay. So once we made the first, all the others take origin from the first and are copies of the first. Our power flowing through all the generations reproduces copies of him. Now, since we constitute you, firstborn daughter of our will, it's necessary that you live with us in order to form the first copy of the soul who lives in the divine will, so that as she lives in us, she may receive our attitude and may learn with our power to operate according to our way. So if he succeeds in getting Louisa at the level he wants, all others can follow. Okay. Once we've made of you the first copy of a soul who lives in the divine will, more copies will follow. It's fascinating, isn't it? So then he tells us in the final paragraph here that it's a long road. The road of our will is extremely long. It embraces eternity. And while it seems that one has navigated the road, much remains to do and to receive from us in order to learn our ways and to form the first copy of the soul who lives in our will. This is the greatest work that we must do. Therefore, we must give you much, and it's necessary to dispose you much so that you may receive. This is the reason for my repeated questions. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you remember the three affirmations? It is to dispose you, to enlarge you, to elevate you in order to accomplish my designs. Now, notice the three things. Excuse me. When Louisa said, yes, I do want to live in your divine will to dispose you. Yes, the second time, to enlarge you. Third time, to elevate you. So each response, he's doing something with us in order to accomplish my designs. I care so much about it that I would leave everything aside to reach my purpose. Now, why does he say that? Because even getting one person to this level, he has achieved so much for the human race. Why? Because this person is going to be repairing, substituting for the whole human race. He's going to be loving and honouring God and glorifying God for the whole human race. So something major has happened to the human race. Can you imagine what's happening with all of us trying to do it? It's really, I don't think we could have any idea how pleased the Lord is with it. Okay. So April the 17th, 1922. The divine will becomes actor of everything within the soul and constitutes her queen of everything. Okay. Continuing in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself, and I found my sweet Jesus, my life and my all. Innumerable suns of light were coming out of him and surrounded him. I flew into the midst of that light and throwing myself into his arms, I clasped him very tightly, telling him, finally, I found you. I'm not going to leave you anymore. Now, tell me somebody who said that to him. At least with her gesture. Easter Day. Mary of Magdalene. John 21. Okay, that's John 21. She threw herself at his feet and grasped his feet. You're not going anywhere. I found you after all this. But you also have the Song of Songs, chapter 3, verse 4, where the bride had lost, in inverted commas, the bridegroom, and when she eventually found him, she did what Mary of Magdala did, or I should say Mary of Magdala did what the bride did, okay, and grasped his feet. You make me wait so long, Louisa said, and I remain without life without you. But I cannot be without life, and therefore I will not leave you any more. And I squeezed him so more tightly for fear that he might escape. And Jesus, as though enjoying my squeezes, told me, my daughter, do not fear. I don't leave you either. He's been telling her that ad nauseam, hasn't he? Mm-hmm. So you know the reference ad nauseam, don't you? Joshua 1:5. See, so, some of the references you should know off by heart now, because you get them so often. Okay. If you cannot be without me, neither can I be without you. In other words, love has met love. So they fuse. And to make you certain that I don't leave you, I want to chain you with my own light. Okay. So the next paragraph is all about chaining us in light. Okay. So Louisa said, I remain so immersed and interwoven within the light of Jesus that it seemed to me that I would no longer find the way out. Now, that's an introduction to what you're going to meet in the higher volumes, where she gets a sense of the divine will as being utterly immense and infinite, and she can go in, but there's no way out at that point. And that's the function of the triple affirmation. Are you coming in? Because if you come in, you're coming into an immensity that you'll not be able to go out of. Because you're going into the immensity that everybody else only goes into in death. Do you know what I mean? Louisa said, how happy I felt and how many things I understood in that light. Beside that, put Psalm 36. 26 I've written down here. Are you sure? I'm not sure about the verse. I have 26 anyway. But it says, in your light we see light. Okay. I lack the words to express myself. I just remember that he said to me, daughter of my will, this light that you see is nothing other than my will. Now, I've been saying that from the beginning. The light is the divine will. Okay. And if you go back and read this over again, reading divine will instead of light, you get this much easier. Okay. So this light is nothing other than my will, which wants to consume your will in order to give you the shape of our image. Now, notice consume your will has to be given completely so that yours is subsumed into the divine. So to give you the shape of our image, that is, of the three divine persons, in such a way that transforming you completely into ourselves, we will leave our volition in you as a divine actor. That means that the moment you let this happen, all your acts are divine acts. You don't have to be asking, okay? You leave us as the divine actor, which matches us in everything we do. So our images will come out from ourselves, and our will acting within you will take as many of them from you. Now, you know that each act is a divine life anyway, don't you? Okay. So the purpose of creation will be fulfilled. So Adam failed, and the Lord is restarting with Louisa. So he's going to talk to us now in the next one about the divine image restored. The echo of our volition will be the echo of our own volition possessed by you. The exchanges will be mutual. Love will be reciprocal. This is the way God intended it with Adam. We will be in full harmony, and the creature will disappear within her creator. Now, do you see, this is the total surrender. The nothing goes into the all. Okay, this is the total surrender. Then nothing else will be lacking to our joy, to our happiness, for which we delivered creation. The let us make man in our own image and likeness will have had its effect. Our will alone as actor within the creature will give completion to everything, and the creation will bring us the divine purpose, and we will receive it in our womb as our work, just as we deliver it. So on earth as it is in heaven. Okay. So here you have the Our Father being fulfilled, but the human will must be subsumed into the divine so that the divine can actually take over. And therefore, in this person, if the divine will is the actor, the one who is doing everything, then you look at that person and you should be able to see God if your eyes were open. But most of us don't have eyes like that, do we? And then he said, if you cannot be without me, it is the echo of my love that resounds in your heart. So it's the calls of the divine. And unable to be without me, it reverberates in you. And you, shaken, look for the one who loves you so much. And I, seeing that you are searching for me, feel the echo of your love within me, and I feel drawn to send you a new current of love so that you may look for me even more. So it's not going to be less painful for her. It's going to be more painful until finally the drop of water is thrown into the wine. Okay. And Louisa said, ah, my love, sometimes as much as I look for you, you don't come. And therefore, now that I have found you, I will not leave you anymore. I will no longer go back to my bed. I cannot. Uh-oh. What's this? She wants to go to heaven, you see. You see, if you taste this level of contact with God, there's nothing back on the earth. I mean, even at the level we're at, I mean, I've said to a number of people, if you got the call today, would you even look back? No. You know, I'm a million miles away from where Louisa was at. But even at the level I'm at, wherever that is, you wouldn't give it a second thought. No. If he said, come, I'd say, you bet. Absolutely. And that's only having tasted the little bit that we've tasted. Mm-hmm. For Louisa, how she managed to live on the earth is amazing to me. I'll no longer go back to my bed. She said, I cannot. I can understand it. You made me wait too long, and I fear that if I go back, you will repeat your privations. And I squeezed him more tightly, repeating, I won't leave you anymore, I won't leave you anymore. And Jesus, although he enjoyed my squeezes, said, my beloved daughter, you are right that you cannot be without me, without your life. But what are we going to do with my will? I love this. I love it. He just knows exactly how to get around things. That's your 2 Corinthians 5:1-10. I want to go and be with the Lord, but the Lord wants me to do this mission, so I have to stay here. Okay. What are we going to do with my will? It's my will that wants you to return to bed. Do not fear, I won't leave you. I will leave the current of the light of my will between you and me. So here he's telling her very, very clearly, the divine will be deposited in you. That's it. Okay, so there's no possibility of us separating. I will leave the current of the light of my will between you and me, and whenever you want me, you will touch the current of light of my volition, and upon its wings, that's the wings of this light of the divine will, I will immediately be with you. Therefore, go back, oh dear, because you see, on the earth, you have to have the pain and the suffering and the merits that go with it. But for nothing other than to allow my will to accomplish its designs. If poor Louisa knew she had to do 36 volumes before she'd be released, I think she would have gone mad. But in the same sense, you know, after Peter said his yes 3 times, if Peter knew that he was going to have to function in Rome, in that cesspool of Rome as it was at the time, he wouldn't have said yes, he would have said I'm going back home. I'm going back to my fishing. That's why God can only tell you things bit by bit. As you grow and you have the strength and you have, he has expanded you and he has disposed you more and all that. We can only take it bit by bit. That's why I call it the jigsaw puzzle. It's fascinating to me. So therefore go back. But for nothing other than to allow my will to accomplish its designs. And the course it wants to make within you. I myself will accompany you to give you the strength to go back. But, oh, goodness of Jesus, it seemed that if he did not have my consent, he himself would not feel like making me go back. This is the delicacy of the thing. She has to go back because she has this big mission, which she cannot grasp, which is perfectly understandable. It's only much, much later in these volumes that she has any grasp of the mission that he's actually giving to her. But at the same time, he wants you to do it voluntarily. And I mean, the delicacy of that position is amazing, isn't it? He would not feel like making me go back, because you see, God won't violate your free will. And as soon as I said, Jesus, do what you want, I found myself back. He got her back instantly, prefer to change her mind. There's where you put your, not my will, but thine be done. Now, the whole day I felt surrounded by light. So it's the first stage is very difficult for her. So he gives her this very, very strong experience. And whenever I wanted him, I touched that light and he would come. The following day, he carried me outside of myself and made me see all created things. And not only was Jesus their creator and dominator, but from him also came the life of the preservation of all things. He's creator and preserver of all things, because that's the divine will. The current of the creative power was in continuous relations with them. And if it were missing, all things would resolve into nothing. Then my sweet Jesus told me, to the daughter of my will, I want to give supremacy over everything. Now she's just seen that he has supremacy over everything. And then he says, I want to give it to her. Why is that? It's because there's only one will between them. So his will would be operating through her anyway. I want to give supremacy over everything. My dominion and hers must be one. So if I'm the king, she must be queen. Okay? And if I gave you knowledge of everything, it's because I want that you not only know my dominions, but that you dominate with me and concur in the preservation of all created things. So she's being asked to do something that is really divine. Now, at the end of the Song of Songs, this wonderful toing and froing that goes on between the bride and the bridegroom, in the end, she says, "Come, let us work in your vineyards." And he says, "Yes, that's where we have to go. That the love between us must be fruitful for others. So you have to go and work in the vineyards." So if he's going to be king, she has to be queen. She has to work in the vineyards. And working in the vineyards, of course, is the reparation and the acts and the rounds and all the rest of it. Just as my will extends from me over all, so I want it to extend from you over all. Because it's the divine will, isn't it? Then he made me notice a point of the world from which black smoke was coming out. And he said, "See, over there are statesmen who want to decide the lots of kingdoms." This is 1922. So he's showing her political leaders who want to carve up Europe and the rest of the world. Around 1922, they were plotting that. Okay. I find it very interesting. They want to decide the lots of the kingdoms, but they do it without me. That's the important bit. "And where I'm not present, there cannot be light. And if there's no light, we won't see." There'll be mistakes made. Because in the early part of the 20th century, they were carving up Africa and all the rest of it, okay? Just to give one example. "They have nothing but the smoke of their passions, which blinds them more. Therefore, they will come up with nothing good." They will come up with something, but nothing good. "It will only serve them to embitter one another and cause graver consequences," which is another war. "Poor peoples led by blind and self-interested men." You'd have to put self-interested there. Oh, and I forgot the text about the blind leading the blind. I'll just write down blind leading the blind. I only thought of it this minute. I don't remember the reference. "Poor peoples led by blind and self-interested men." You see, if they were disinterested, they'd be right. So it's self-interested. "These men will be pointed to as the laughing stock of history." Now, it's early in the 20th century, and the Three Stooges were Hitler, Stalin and Mussolini. They were called the Three Stooges by someone famous. But now there were other people as well wanting to carve up the geography books. "They will be the laughing stock of history, good only at bringing ruin and confusion." And those three that I've mentioned brought nothing but ruin and confusion. Now, there were lots of others as well. You can write the full list if you want. "But let us withdraw, let us leave them at their own mercy." Because if people are cruel, they're cruel to everybody, including themselves. "That they may know what it means to do things without me." And he disappeared and I found myself inside of myself. Here she's getting... at the beginning of that paragraph, you need to put Amos 3:7. "The Lord never does anything without showing it to the prophets first." Okay. So we'll do April the 21st, 1922. "The effects of prayer in the most holy will of God." Do I need to tell you, put a VIP on that one? "Everything that I have written and that I write is only to obey, and much more, for fear that my Jesus, being displeased, may find a pretext to deprive me of him. He alone knows how much it costs me. So I spent one day without Jesus, just a few shadows of him. Oh God, what pain. I was saying to myself how soon he broke his promise of not leaving me." Now he's inside of her. As you know, she doesn't accept that. She wants something much more visible. Holy eternal volition, bring me my highest good, my all. The pain I felt was such that I felt huffy and fussy. And in this state, I tried to fuse myself. I love the I tried to fuse myself in his holy volition. In the meantime, he came, showing himself as crying bitterly and with his heart cut to pieces. In seeing him crying, I put my huffiness aside. That's a good one. And hugging him and drying his tears, I said to him, "What is it, Jesus? Why do you cry? Tell me, what have they done to you?" And he said, "Ah, my daughter, they want to challenge me. They are preparing for me an awful challenge." It's very interesting now. And it's from the leaders. Okay? "My sorrow is such that I feel my heart being cut to pieces. How just it is that my justice pour itself out against the creatures. Therefore, come into my will together with me. Let us rise between heaven and earth and adore together the supreme majesty. Let us bless it, give it homage for all, so that heaven and earth may be filled with adorations, homages, blessing, and all may receive its effects." What do you think that could have happened that Jesus would have said was a terrible challenge to him? Yeah, you have the infiltration of the church by communism, putting atheists into the church. Do you know what I mean? So that's the one thing I can think of. Yeah, because it was going to be such a horrendous crisis for the church. Yeah. Okay, that's the only thing I can think of, because that was what was going on at the time. So Louisa said, "I spent the morning praying together with Jesus." Isn't that lovely? Surprise, as we prayed, now you can't say one was the word. There was one word between us. And the word was the same. Okay, it was only one. In other words, there weren't two prayers. There was one prayer. There wasn't two wills. There was one will. There wasn't two requests. There was one request. And it's just that's very bad English. But the divine volition diffused it all over created things, and its mark remained on all of them. Now you're seeing the effect of acts in the divine will. It brought it to heaven, and not only did the blessed receive its mark, we would say the effects of the act, but it was, we'd have to say, the cause of a new beatitude for them. The cause of a new beatitude for them. It descended down below into the earth and even into purgatory, and all received its effects. So there's the act in the divine will actually affecting everybody. But who can say how it was to pray with Jesus and all the effects that it produced? So she says something very important here. In the last paragraph, "Then after we prayed together, he told me, 'My daughter, have you seen what it means to pray in my will?'" Now, this paragraph is one of the ones you need to really take out, because it'll answer questions people will ask you. Do you know what I mean? "Just as there is no point at which my volition does not exist, it circulates in everything and in everyone. It is life, actor and spectator of everything. In the same way the acts done in my volition become life, actors and spectators of everything, even of the very joy, beatitude and happiness of the saints. Everywhere they bring light and the balsamic and celestial air which unleashes joys and happiness. Therefore, never depart from my will. Heaven and earth await you to receive new joy and new splendor." Now, heaven and earth await you is Romans 8:19. Waiting for the new sons of God to show themselves, who will have this incredible effect. So here you're being told that the acts in the divine will affect everybody in heaven, earth and purgatory. It's fantastic, isn't it? I know you've heard it before, but every time I hear it, it's new. I don't know for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the same to me as if I was hearing it the first time. Yeah. That's why I never get tired hearing it. So April the 25th, 1922, I have a VIP on this one as well. "Thousands of angels are the guardians and custodians of acts done in the divine will." This is brilliant. So, continuing my usual state, I felt all immersed in the divine volition, and my sweet Jesus told me, my daughter, just as the sun does not leave the plant, but caresses it with light, fertilizes it, we would say, with its heat until it produces flowers and fruits, and then, jealous, it makes them mature. It keeps them with its light, and when the farmer picks it to make it its food, only then will it leave the fruit. This is the same with the acts done in my will. Now notice that the sun is compared to the power of God's love working in us. That's actually what that paragraph is about. It's the same with the acts done in my will. My love, my jealousy towards, these are the acts done in the divine will, is such that grace caresses them. My love conceives them. My love fertilizes them. And my love matures them. I place thousands of angels as custodians of one single act done in my will. Does he prize it? Oh, absolutely. In fact, since these acts done in my will are seeds, in order that my will may be done on earth as it is in heaven, everyone is jealous of these acts. Their dew is my breath. Isn't that wonderful? Their shadow is my light. The angels remain enraptured by them because the angels can't do acts in the divine will like we do, because whatever they do, it doesn't carry the merits that we have. So they look at us astounded that we have this privilege. The angels remain enraptured by them and reverent, they adore them, because in these acts they see the eternal will, which deserves all of their adoration. Only when I find souls who, picking them as divine fruits, make of them food for their own souls, that is somebody that the act we do in the divine will is affecting everybody in heaven, on earth and in purgatory. And he said, I only leave it when somebody actually takes it and uses it for themselves, just like the fruit. So they've taken the apple and they've eaten it, or they've taken the banana and they've eaten it. He said, because then the work of producing that thing is now complete. It has given food. So he said, only then does the action stop. Oh, the fecundity, or we'd say fertility, and multiplicity of these acts. The creature herself who does them cannot count them. That's a wonderful piece there about acts, isn't it? Mm. And the next paragraph is that the acts in the divine will put you in communication with everything. So if you want to teach acts, here's an excellent one, okay? I'm giving you these little notes every now and then because you will be teaching them, okay? Then I was thinking to myself, how is it possible that these acts are so great? My book says B, which is not English. And why do even angels remain enraptured? And Jesus, clasping me more tightly in his arms, added, my daughter, these acts are so great that as the soul keeps doing them, there is nothing either in heaven or on earth in which she does not take part. Isn't that unbelievable? She remains in communication with all created things, all the good, the effects, the value of the heavens, the sun, the stars, the water, the fire, etc., are not only in continuous relations with her, they are her own things. What is yours is mine, because it's a divine act. Isn't that fantastic? She harmonizes with the whole of creation, and the whole of creation harmonizes with her, and therefore she becomes the person mentioned in Romans 8:19. First of all, it's Louisa, because she entered fully into the divine will, and then as each one of us enter into this, we become the people that Paul spoke about, that the whole of creation was waiting for these sons of God to show up, because that was what was going to bring renewal to the whole earth. Okay. So the next paragraph is even more astounding. The heading I have here is, souls in the divine will become the support of their God. Can you imagine? Yeah, souls in the divine will become the support of their God. So, why then? Because those who live in my will are the depositaries, the preservers, the supporters, and the defenders of my will. Is that something else? The depository, first of all, he can place his divine will in you. The preservers, you will actually keep the divine will there. You will support and defend the divine will in all your acts. They foresee what I want, and without my commanding, they execute what I want. Now, there's something about divine will acts you need to really take on board. Because when we're doing all these readings and everything, all of us are giving different responses. We're not carbon copies of each other. Okay. And the Lord says that without him giving any of us a command, we are actually responding to what he wants to accomplish from different angles. That's why I keep on saying everybody has to be spontaneous, not doing the same thing, just the spontaneous thing that comes out of your own being. And he said, everything that he wants will be done. I find that fascinating. Okay. And it is without commanding. In other words, he hasn't laid down a law that this is what you've got to say. And comprehending or understanding the greatness and the sanctity of my will, they keep it and they defend it jealously. So we all appreciate as much as we possibly can the greatness of the privilege of being able to do divine will acts. So we do defend it and look after it. How could anyone not remain enraptured in seeing these souls who form the support of their God? Now, this time it's you and me. It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. It's no. I've only one comment for that. Wow, as I write it in the margin. The support of their God by virtue of is by the power of the prodigy of the divine will. Who can ever defend my rights if not one who lives in my will? Who can ever really love me if not one who can love me with divine love, understood? Okay. With a love of disinterest similar to my love, if not one who lives in my will. I feel stronger in these souls, but strong of my own strength, because all the actions are done on the divine level. I am like a king surrounded by faithful ministers who feels stronger, more glorious, more sustained in the midst of his faithful ones than by himself alone. Isn't that fantastic? If he remains alone, he regrets not having his ministers because he has no one with whom to pour himself out and to whom to entrust the lot of his kingdom. That's the way I am. And whoever, who could ever be more faithful to me than one who lives in my will? I feel my will being duplicated, and therefore I feel more glorious. I pour myself out in them and I trust them. Now, that is the most astounding statement, that God could trust a creature of his. I think it's a good place to stop.